This is Interpreting Wine podcast founder and host Lawrence Francis welcoming you to my first ever deep dive into a single producer with Waterford Distillery of Ireland. This is the type of series I've been wanting to make ever since starting the podcast back in 2017, giving as it does unrivaled access for you, the listener, to all levels of the company, from strategy and history right the way through every single production detail. I think you'll agree Waterford are doing something very special, and I'd highly recommend subscribing to the podcast so that you're alerted whenever new episodes go live. Today's episode of the Waterford Distillery Special features CEO Mark Rainier. Picking up where he left off in episode 373, Mark takes us into Waterford and its terroir, talking barley varieties and scientific investigation of terroir, before giving us a masterclass in the Waterford production processes, talking single farmer barley, malting, milling, brewing, low and slow distillation, Atlantic aging, maturation, before looking ahead to the first whiskey releases and how these will show up in the marketplace via Waterford whiskey and single farm releases. Enjoy.
So terroir. Well, you all know what terroir is. You know, the influence of microclimate and soil and topography. You know, it's what makes Burgundy tick. You've got 8,000 wines made with one grape variety, Pinot Noir, and yet, you know, they're all different. Winemaking technique, yeah, obviously. But, you know, in 1,000 years of monastic observation of how this grapes grow in these different spots. You know, remember, you know, the Côte d'Or. The Côte d'Or is an escarpment. It's sedimentary rocks laid down flat, eolitic limestones, whatever. And they've been folded into an escarpment. And it's been shuffled by slumping. It's like shuffling a pack of cards, you know? And that's why you've got, these narrow bands, you know, 10 yards apart, where you've got La Tache, and then the other side of the road, you've got Romani Conti, and then you've got Richebourg, you know, three very different wines, even if they're made by the same guy, you know, like DRC or whatever. You know, that's terroir. It's fantastic. It's amazing. Or you go the other extreme. You go to Bordeaux, and you've got the big wineries, so, you know, the La Tours and the Lafites, you know, 35, 40 hectares, you know, with five great varieties suited to the microclimates and terroirs around their estate. You know, Merlot suited to clay soils and gravelly soils to the Cabernet Sauvignon. And then they vinify those wines separately, and they then assemble them into a grand vin. Well, that's what I'm doing. That's what I'm doing with whiskey. I'm creating a grand vin. I'm making a grand vin made up of five different grape varieties or barley varieties grown on different terroirs, harvested separately, distilled separately, put into barrels separately. And then several years later, assembling them in varying proportions to create the grand vin. So on the one hand, it's influenced by Château Latour, Château Lafite, the grand vin, the complexity. On the other, the terroir of Burgundy, which is in my blood. And that's what I'm doing. That's what we started doing with Bruichladdich. But I've been able to perfect with Waterford. Waterford is on the same latitude as Cambridge. Much easier to grow barley in Cambridge than on a Hebridean island. And that's why I went there. I went there for the barley. Another serendipitous meeting, which, you know, you've probably deduced, you know, this whole thing is about various serendipitous moments. But an old engineer, Duncan McGilvery, telling me one day, one sunny afternoon, how the greatest barley he's ever seen since the 60s came from Southern Ireland. And I remember that. I remember him telling me that. And so when I looked for a new project, when Remy Quantro bought Bruichladdich, it was to Ireland I went because of the barley. Also the fact that it's a bit Wild West, not much going on there at the time. It's now hotted up considerably. But it was the barley. That's what I wanted. And that's where I found a discarded brewery, Guinness Brewery, built by Diageo. And I bought that and converted it into a distillery. I took the two stills we had at Bruichladdich that we stole originally from Inverleven, on the River Leven, a tributary of the Clyde. And we stole those back in 2003 when they were demolishing the Dumbarton distillery complex. And in there was this one little small single malt distillery called Inverleven. And it had these two stills that were built in 74, I think it was, 74, 75, by Blair's. And we shipped them to Bruichladdich, and they sat there outside Bruichladdich. And so when I left, I bought them off the company and shipped them to Waterford and installed them into this super high-tech distillery. So you got all the stainless steel of a super fancy 2004 Guinness distillery, and the copper from Inverleven from 1974, and proceeded to make single malt whiskey in Ireland. But this time we had the chance to set up the logistics, which is the thing that allows this all to happen. People don't really understand the degree of logistics that you need. On Islay, we didn't have that. We didn't have the setup. We had the goodwill of the farmers, but we didn't have the physical setup to allow us to differentiate the crops properly. So therefore, we weren't able to really put into effect, how we would have liked our single farm policy. Just like the Bordeaux example, Cabernet Franc, Malbec, Petit Verdot, Merlot. We run roughly five a harvest, five varieties a harvest. For the similar reasons, you get different characteristics according to different weather profiles, with different weather patterns, a certain element of covering your bets, covering your bases. But of course the difference is with barley is they haven't been cultivated. They haven't been propagated with flavor in mind. It's about yield. It's economically driven. All the experimentation is about how to make barley higher yielding off the field and in the distillery. More liters of alcohol and more tons per acre. That's what's driven barley evolution. It's not about flavor, which is a very sad thing. So actually that's retrospective. That's starting to happen now. And there's work going on where people are trying to identify, what it is that gives different varieties different, flavor backgrounds. So a lot of work is going on that at the moment. In fact, that led to our own terroir proving project when I discovered an American scientist who'd written a thesis on exactly that. He was looking to make better tasting barley. He set out to make a sort of greatest hits of barley. And so in that process, he'd identified specific varieties and was trying to find out what made them so interesting. And I read this research that he was doing, and I realized that, you know, in that research, he'd actually proven the concept of terroir. Now, believe it or not, no one up to that point has ever scientifically proven that terroir exists. Nobody. You know, the French just take it for granted. You know, the whole Bordeaux market that's predicated on terroir, the whole Burgundy market, the whole appellation d'origine contrôlée in Burgundy, based on terroir, it relies on medieval monks. No one has actually bothered to scientifically prove that terroir exists until now. So for the last 3 years with this guy, Dr. Dustin Herb, I got him over to Ireland. I said, look, you won't believe this, but nobody... So we set up with the Irish Agricultural Ministry, Cork University, and with Tatlock and Thompson in Scotland, the biggest whiskey consultancy, we set up the definitive terroir study, and the results of which we've now got in. It's been written up. It'll be peer-reviewed in the International Brewer and Distiller are going to write it up. And it will appear round about Christmas time. And I can tell you right now that you will be pleased to know that terroir does exist. Blow me down, yeah, with a feather. It does exist, but we, you know, it's been quite a job to do it properly, because you can bet your bottom dollar that all the big guys are going to come after and try and discredit it and say no, it doesn't exist, because if it exists, then the people are going to ask questions. Where do you get your barley from? And when they say, we get it on the commodity market in Paris, and it may come from Ukraine, it may come from Poland, it may come from Scandinavia, but the one place it isn't going to come from is Scotland. You know, it begs a lot of questions. So you know, once again, they'll try and shut down the discussion because it's inconvenient, while at the same time they'll try and steal all the clothes, the emperor's clothes. They'll try and steal all the accoutrements to their maximum effect. So that's why you're going to see a lot about terroir bandied around by every Tom, Dick and Harry without having the remotest idea what it means or doing anything about it. They're just going to squeeze it and bleed it dry. Where on the other hand, we've got people like us who have set up the infrastructure to actually, you know, believe it and do it. So we have what we call a cathedral. It's a huge warehouse divided up into 40 bins. Each one takes roughly 100 tons of green barley. Each one from a different farm around central southeast Ireland. So that we're entering it now, the harvest period now, we have something in the region of 5,500 tons of barley winging its way around little single track country roads. And we have to keep it separate from field to trailer to storage. It has to be dried down to 14%. So that it doesn't rot. And that all has to be done within 24 hours. So we have our own dedicated warehouse system for that, our own dryer, our own bins. So each farm has its own bin. So we can keep it separate. And that's where the terroir journey starts. That's keeping it separate off the field. variety by variety, farm by farm. And then once we've got it dried and stored, it goes into a dormancy period. And then by the spring, early spring, February, it starts to come out of that dormancy and it can be malted. And so the traceability continues through malting, which is the process of, you know, creating the sugars in the grain from starch. The sugar converts to the starch converts to sugar to provide the grain with the energy to grow little roots and little shoots to create a barley plant. But we don't want the barley plant, we want the sugar, so we have to stop it. And that's what the dehydration process is about, which is the main part of the malting process. The first dehydration, when it comes in off the field, is to get it down from its natural humidity of sort of 18-19%, which if you stored it like that, it would rot. So you desiccate it down to 14%, so you can store it. The malting is basically tricking the grain into thinking it's springtime. So it's basically imitating spring rains. So you hydrate it, you dehydrate it, you hydrate it, you dehydrate it. So the grain thinks, oh, you know, springtime, and it's and the enzymes, you know, the maltase, fructase, sucrase start converting that starch into sugars. And it's those sugars that that you're after. So that's the process of malting. It's a trick. It's trickery. And the malting process is you don't have to malt. You can use green malt, but then you have to start adding things. And I don't like adding things. And so everything I do is natural, totally natural. There are no additives. That nothing. It's barley, yeast, and water. Nothing is added. No gibberellic acid. No E150. No, you know, enzymes. No, you know, nothing is added. Zippo. So we malt. The maltings we use is small bobby maltings built in Bury St Edmunds. Which is located in Athy, which is slap bang in the middle of our barley field area for strategic logistical reasons. So we basically control one whole sector of that maltings. So it's our, you know, the next best thing to having our own maltings. So the barley is called on in rotation, as it comes out of dormancy, to be malted and sent down to us at the distillery. And each farm, we can store three farms at a time. And each farm, from the moment it arrives with its passport, both digital and paper passport, part of the traceability bespoke system that we've created, allows us, it takes us 10 days roughly for it to go right through. And this is where the modernity of Waterford, this stainless steel, shiny distillery, comes into its own. We nicknamed it the facilitator, because to me, it's not really a distillery. It's enabling us to extract terroir. This is terroir extraction. More than distillation. This is what it seems to me. And we got a couple of bits of kit that are unusual, but used our way are sort of terroir enforcers. And one of those is the first process, which is mashing, the extraction of that sugar, which in a normal distillery, that grain goes through a mill to be ground into a flour or a grist, and water it's then added to a vat or a tank, a mash tun of hot water. And that hot water dissolves the sugar and it percolates through the grain, the grist, through a slotted floor. That's more or less the process. It's a percolation, so that the hot water dissolves the sugar that it's got access to, having been through the mill and ground into a flour, and it percolates through the mass of the husks and the bits and pieces through the slotted floor and away, and it comes out as a sort of brownish, wonderfully malty, sweet, sticky liquid called wort, W-O-R-T, wort, or wort. But we have a different way of doing it, because Guinness, in their wisdom, installed a very fancy piece of kit by a Belgian company called Mura. And it's an extractor. So what we do is we have a mill that's called a hydro mill. So it's a mill that operates not underwater. That'd be ridiculous. It operates with water going through it. So instead of the water being added at the mash tun, the water is added at the milling stage, which means that the milling is less aggressive, but it means you can grind it down more, and it's all done under in sort of anaerobic conditions. And then that porridgey mix then goes into a mash tun to sit for a while, a tank to sit, and you know, for the hot water to melt those sugars, and then it goes into this what would you call it? You call it a filter, a mash filter is what we call it. And it's a series of 50 or so plates arranged longitudinally. So, you know, if you imagine each one is a bit like a pneumatic press that you have for a vineyard, and it works on the same principle that you put in the grapes and a balloon is inflated to squish the grapes, which gives you extraordinary precision. The same thing, we are putting in the wort, the mash with the porridgey likeness of the hot sweet grainy mix, and inflate the bags to squeeze it, and that happens 50 times in tandem. Of course, it was designed for efficacy for brewing, but actually used our way, it's like the ultimate terroir extractor. You're getting every last drop of terroir out of that grain. It's one of those things where, we didn't really know what it would do when we started, but boy, are we pleased with the results. It's not how it was intended. It's not what it was meant for, but it really does a great job for us, and extracts every last bit of terroir out of that barley. So that then goes into fermentation vessels. We have 100,000 litre capacity. They're big, and they're conical and they're tall. And so fermentation, and of course they are temperature controlled. They have glycol going around them. So again, this is something you wouldn't normally find in a distillery, is temperature controlled fermentation vessels. Well, we've got them coming out of our ears. So it allows you to control the temperature. So as temperature of fermentation rises, we can cool it down. We can extend it. Now, you know, we were talking earlier on about certainly some of the advances, enological advances during the 80s. And one of those was about temperature control during fermentation. You know, I can remember visiting some guys in Vaughan Romanée, and their idea of temperature control was to move vats outside, you know, in hot weather. You know, that was temperature control. You know, and some of them would bung a radiator, you know, with a hose pipe on each end into a vat, you know, and run cold water. You know, that was temperature control. You know, well, it's a little bit more sophisticated these days. You know, so and of course, same with us. It's we've got some very clever fermentation vessels, and of course, we have the data. This is one of the wonderful things. Going from the sublime to the ridiculous, going from that Victorian simplicity of Bruichladdich, which I love and I will always love, to the opposite, to the you know the state of the art stainless steel microchipped futuristic Blade Runner like facilitator that is Waterford. Where for the first time, you actually know what's going on in real time. You're not reacting to what's happened. You are in control. You are distilling with the awareness of what's actually happening as it happens. It's an enormously empowering moment to watch, to see what's happening and say, right, okay, well, a little bit more here, a little bit more there, you know. You are in control. You are actually distilling, mm-hmm. instead of just sitting back and say, "Oh no, don't touch that. It hasn't been touched for the last 50 years." You know, God's sake, don't touch that. You know, this is hands on. So it's a much more evolved, involved experience, and of course, with every single farm producing different barley, well, guess what? They respond differently. When they ferment, they respond differently. When they malt, they respond differently. And you have to optimize and adapt and adjust all the time. And of course, all that data gets recorded because Diageo, in their wisdom, have data collecting all over the place, which was inevitably to make spirit or beer cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. But actually, if you turn that around and use it the other way, it's actually, you know, information that you can store to support the decisions you make during those processes. So that when someone says, "Is that whiskey the same as that one?" you can go, "Yes." And here's and you can see they were fermented the same way, or not, as the case may be. So it's about data control. So for the first time in my life, in my career, you know, you are empowered with a myriad of data, which, you know, in the early days, you used to get all those. Do you remember those printouts? You know, that no one would ever look at, just papers and pages and pages. You know. I can remember my first stage in Alsace in around about 1980, and I was sent to Dopf and Erion, which at the time was an independent, the major Alsace house. Marvelous guy Guy Dopf and Louis Erion, and they were really leading the way in single vineyard Alsace wines at the time, and I was sent there, and I met this lovely guy who was doing one of the very first ever direct mail campaigns in France, and they had this whopping great big computer that double the size of that sofa, and this guy Paul Adam, an Alsatian, And he was saying, yeah, you know, this is the future. This is the way, you know, look what this can do. You know, we've got every doctor, every dentist, you know, got all their details on this computer. And we can send them, you know, targeted mail offerings, you know, for wine and foie gras and things like that, you know. And I remember saying to him, I said, that's amazing. That's extraordinary. I said, what's this button do? And I pressed it. And it started printing the whole mailing list. And there was no way of stopping it. And it went for 5 days, printing. Ching, 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 ching. Anyhow, apart from that, low and slow is a philosophy about, you know, slowing everything down. You know, slowing the fermenter. It's not a race. It's not a, you know, big brewing, distilling, you know, winemaking is about getting in and out as quickly as possible. High density fermentation, it's called. You put double the volume of yeast in. You have a really aggressive fermentation. Bish bash bosh. You get over that bottleneck as quickly as you can. Out it goes. But of course, you know, you end up with volatility. You don't end up with purity. You know, we knew that from the, you know, from those early days, you know, the 80s, about these enological advances. That if you controlled fermentation, if you cooled it down and stopped it going off like the clappers, you know, you would get more purity of flavor. You'd get darker wines, but you'd get more purity of flavor. You know, if you had an aggressive fermentation that was over and done with very quickly, you'd get, you know, huge jammy wines, but very little complexity and very little sort of balance and harmony. You know, that was more or less the battle of ideas at the time. And some people, you know, do you remember, you know, you probably don't, but, you know, guys like Guy Acad and one or two of these gurus that came along that sort of took it a step too far. And you ended up with sort of very pale, sort of, you know, odd wines. And, you know, there were, it wasn't all, you know, easy going. There were, you know, people that followed that sort of advice, people that followed other advice. But, you know, more or less, it was a learning era, you know, of that generation, you know, the 80s. A lot of experimentation, a lot of reputations were tarnished at that time by following the wrong guru. But more or less, the principle was that, you know, being in control of fermentation, you know, being in control of the vineyard, making sure that the grapes weren't overproduced, you know, in a canopy management, which they learned from the Australians, spacing of vines, grass down the middle, you know, all these things that were being explored and experimented with, they those happened in the 80s and the 90s, and into the cuvery. Stainless steel, you know, pumps, you know, hygiene, you know, I mean, a lot of that just didn't exist. So you know, wooden fermentation versus stainless steel. So whilst we have a fully automated distillery, I mean, what that means is the valves needed to run, you know, the wort or the wash, where, you know, are opened and closed automatically in sequence, basically to make sure you don't cock up, to make sure you don't create vacuums and, you know, things which are detrimental. So really, automate all that. It doesn't mean you run the thing with any fewer people. All it means is that you know the valves open and shut in the right order, and more or less that's what it means. And so when it comes to actual distillation, the cuts, we do those manually, because I think it's important that human connection between the distiller and the spirit that he's making is there. So you know, they have to make the cut manually, because each one is different. You know, you can't automate that. Each one is different. So the perversity is we've got a really state-of-the-art distillery, but we're sort of running it semi-manually, trying to slow it down and calm it down. And you know, hence the mantra of low and slow. when, you know, it could very easily be Fast and Furious. So that's what we do. So you know, going from that sort of wonderful simplicity, Victorian simplicity, which I adore, to this state of the art, you know, is quite a jump. But boy, you know, I can see the benefits of both. So it's very interesting. So the spirit coming off those pot stills, yeah, sure. The Inverleven stills. That gives you an idea of the style of the spirit. You know, we knew from day one that it would be a floral, fruity spirit, thanks to the shape of those stills. I mean, they were built in 74, but they were only ever used for about 8 years before that Inverleven place was shut down. And then they were shipped to Bruichladdich, where they weren't used. So actually, they haven't had that long in use. So we've probably got another sort of 5 or 6 years of use in them before we need to replace them. So the typicity of the spirit, the weight of the spirit, is influenced by that shape.
The long neck.
Yes, that's right. Which means the vapor's got further to go. And therefore, it touches the sides. It condenses. It's called reflux. It then drips back down into the body of the still to get revaporized. And each time, it's getting purer and purer and lighter, till eventually it doesn't touch the sides at all. It goes straight up the middle. And that is, you know, where, you know, a lot of the congeners, the things you don't really want, stay in the body of the still. And the pure, elegant elements are the ones that end up going through the condensers to be condensed back into spirit, that come out of the spirit safe. And that gets stored in a tank until we have enough to ship to our warehouse. But We have a small warehouse on site, but we're in the city. Don't forget, we're in Waterford City on the banks of the River Shure, so we don't have the room for warehousing there. And besides, we want that Atlantic twang, shall we call it? So we have a warehouse complex 5 miles away on the coast, the south coast of Ireland. The Copper Coast, as it's known. And the warehouses are half a mile from the wild Atlantic. So very reminiscent of Bruichladdich in Islay. And warehouses that we've built, we've designed to optimize that exposure to the Atlantic. So we've you know, they're hold like a Swiss cheese, you know, to take advantage of the marine environment, which I'm a great believer in. It's something that was poo-pooed by all the big distilling companies. It doesn't matter where you mature it, you know, because basically they mature their stuff in big sort of warehouses in Glasgow or, you know, Leven or wherever. But it does make a difference, and, you know, research has been done to that effect. I think McCallan did some. That shows that where you mature the spirit it influences how it matures. You know, alcohol is, it absorbs flavors. You know, I mean, you know, in a simplistic way, you know, if you think of a perfume, you know, what is it? A perfume is a bunch of rosemary and neutral alcohol. And you put the two together and you end up with rosemary flavored alcohol and a bunch of twigs. You know, that's more or less what happens. You know, it's known that if you store barrels of whiskey next to an oil refinery, it starts smelling of oil. You know, if you put it next to a pig farm, it starts smelling of pigs. You know, this is known. So put it beside the Atlantic. And you know, you get a brininess that comes through into the spirit. And we noticed this at Brookladdie between stuff that had been stored central Scotland and the same spirit, the same years that had been stored on Islay, there was a demonstrable difference. And yet, oh, no, it's just, you know, poop, you know, folklore, blah, 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 blah. There's no salt in malt. There's this, I mean, it's just laughable. And it's, funny enough, you know, what's doing it is actually a gas, a marine gas called DMS, dimethyl sulfide. In heavy concentrations, it's horrible. In very light concentrations, it's adorable, and it goes from truffles at one extreme to it destroys stuff. DMS, and it's the gas that's given off on a beach by seaweed, algae. It's what birds navigate around the planet. You know, seabirds, and albatross, and all that. They navigate around that because they are very sensitive to DMS. DMS is at its greater concentrations where you've got seaweed rotting. You know, any of you, walked past. I mean, you know, on Islay, there's Stinky Corner, where seaweed just outside Bridgend, where there's a sort of back eddy that sort of seaweed ends up. And it rots away, and it stinks to high heaven. That's a very, very high concentration of DMS, and that's not nice. But that marine ozone, you know, that's sort of, you know, the doctors saying, go walk by the fresh air, the ozone, and that's DMS in adorable concentration, a very light concentration. And that's, you know, from the, you know, storms, you know the algae, the tide going out, the tide coming in, the tide, you know it's that foreshore after the tide goes out. That is what the air coming straight in is loaded with. And that's what, you know, if you mature barrels by the sea, by, you know, I hasten to add a foreshore, you need a foreshore, and it's no use having just straight sort of, you know, see, you need a foreshore at a prevailing wind. That's where you get this marineness. And, you know, in our days of Murray McDavid, you know, we noticed this from barrel samples. You may have a distillery located by the sea, but if the barrels aren't there, you don't get that influence. You know, it's where the barrels are matured, not where the spirit is made. So there's spirits like a Royal Brackler, which is matured by the sea. A lot of Islay whiskies are distilled there, but they're not matured there. The vast bulk is matured, you know, in central Scotland. It's poo-pooed as being, you know, propaganda. No, it isn't. It just takes an inquisitive mind, to look at it.
And learning from other areas.
It's an inquisitive mind. Why? Well, you know, in the wine, you wouldn't just deny it just because it's inconvenient. Well, Manthanilla, for God's sake. Manthanilla. You've got a whole bloody AOC, Manthanilla, which is Fino, matured. Not at Jerez inland, but at Sanlúcar, precisely to take advantage of those winds. You know, it's okay for that to have an AOC, but for some reason, you know, it's not possible with a higher concentration of alcohol to do the same thing, according to the industry. You know, so these are the vagaries you're up against in this misinformation campaign. So when it comes to maturation, we would love to have been able to sell, you know, new spirit, you know, straight off, because it's very, very interesting to see the terroir effects in the new spirit, unadulterated, no wood, nothing. You know, here it is. The only difference is the origin of that barley. Now, you know, if it's been distilled slightly differently, we can tell. You know, we've got the information. So we know what the control, you know, so we can match real, you know, differences down to only the variety or only the field, the soil, the terroir that it grew in. There's roughly 20 different soil types in central Ireland. And we have essentially, it's not exact, but essentially two farms per soil type. So we've got lots of comparisons to make. Some have been malted slightly differently. Some have been fermented slightly differently. Some have been distilled slightly differently. We've got all that data. So we know what we're comparing, you know, like for like. And on the one hand, we have to distill hand to mouth because the raw ingredient is different each time, which is in itself a terroir proving. And you know, you can't just twiddle the number, you know, the dials and say, well, that's it, all set. You know, that's it for the rest of the year. And now I can remember, you know, at Brocladdy, you know, we got this phone call from another distiller saying, look, you know, are your yields going down? And we said, well, no. And this distillery hadn't adjusted their mill in 10 years. They had the same settings all the time. And even with you know, a commodity barley coming from Central Europe, you know, even you know, harvest to harvest, it's going to be slightly different. And they were still not changing their mill, and then wondering why they weren't getting the ever declining yields. So yes, it works on both ways round. So the spirit into the wood, we like to use French oak, because Quercus robur gives a very different flavor profile. You know, it's simplistically, it gives a sort of toasted butter, buttered toast flavor. Whereas American oak, Quercus alba, gives a much more simplistic flavor, a sort of creme brulee flavor. There's not a great deal of variation. It's a much more simplistic flavor, and it gives a lot of color. It gives a lot of vanilla-iness. Whereas French oak gives, you know, a sort of more complex, more compelling, drier, toastier flavor. But French oak is much harder to use. American oak's a doddle. It's really simple. But French oak has to be used very carefully. This is what we learned at Brocladdy. It requires proactive monitoring. You can't just fill barrels and leave them because the effect can be too great. You have different levels of forest. You know, as I said earlier, you know, Allier, Trancet, Vosges, Limousin, Bertrange, different altitudes. The trees grow at different rates. They have different grains as a consequence. They've been identified for different wines. You know, Grand Crus will use Limousin, Allier, but they may be too strong for lesser wines, etc., etc. And it's the same for us. We're putting 70% alcohol into these things. We reject the industry status quo, which is standardized 63.5% alcohol. We prefer putting it straight in as it comes off the still, 70%. So 70-71% it goes in. So it's an extra 7% alcohol of extractionableness because it's just pulling out that, you know, what's in that barrel. So the newer the oak, the more that's extracted. The more that's extracted, the more dangerous it is. And the more you know, careful you've got to be in using them, because you don't want to end up with just, you know, tannin, you know, the wood tannins, because that would be a bit, you know, a bit dull. So a proactive wood policy is something you cannot walk away from. You've got to be there. You've got to be dealing with it. and it needs a comprehensive look. So each farm we distill deliberately goes into the same profile of wood. So that is approximately 30% virgin oak, half of which would be American, half of which would be French. So that, you know, woo, gives a lot of flavor, a lot of color, a lot of vanilla. And then 70% will be first fill barrels. Again, more or less 50-50 between American oak and French oak. Half the French oak barrels will be sweet wines. We call them VDNs, vin du naturel. You obviously heard of the predilection for sherry barrels and stuff. You know, well, that was fine when sherry was bottled in the UK. And every granny drank, you know, sort of sickly sherry. But that was sort of, you know, along with Miss Marple, died off a long time ago. And in 1988, the Spaniards stopped exporting sherry in bulk, qualitatively deciding that it had to be bottled in Spain. So that was the end of sherry barrels. Boing. 1988. So, funny enough, you know, those dates start sort of, it all start aligning up, and you sort of start realizing caramel, E150, barrels. And of course, that's you know, part of the story. You know, if you didn't get that sweetness and darkness from sherry wood, you know, you'd get it from E150 instead. But people had become addicted to the concept of sherry barrels. And so, yes, there are barrel makers in Spain making barrels that are sherry barrels or barrels made in sherry land. But they're not sherry barrels like you're thinking, which are shipping barrels that held sherry. They're barrels deliberately being made for the sherry industry so that distilleries can go, oh, look, I use sherry barrels. But they're basically new barrels, new American oak, with a couple of bottles of sherry, you know, wallowing around inside them and being, you know, sold as sherry barrels. They're not really, they're barrels made in sherry land. There are, of course, you know, Solera barrels. Barrels that, you know, that sit there, and it's the sherry that moves, the barrels don't. And some of those can be, you know, 100 years old. They're basically sponges. You know, the wood is dead, inert, but, you know, it's you know, they just had sweet stuff in it for years. And, you know, and of course, that will give you huge darkness and sweetness. But, I mean, it's pretty dumb, pretty, you know, dull and few and far between. So the whole sherry scam, sherry wood scam, is just that. So I started looking elsewhere. You know, if sherry is a vin du naturel, as is port, as is Madeira, what else is there? And of course, you know, you start looking on the other side of the Pyrenees, and there's, you know, Banyuls, and there's Rivesalt, and there's Moray, and so we rounded up all those barrels. But of course, a lot of those older producers use vats, they don't use barrels. So, you know, so hogsheads and stuff are relatively few and far between. So we euphemistically call any sweet wine barrels VDN, vin du naturel. So that Sauterne barrels, Clemens barrels, Yquem barrels, you know, anything that's had something sweet in them are quite useful, because the moment you put 70% alcohol in, it extracts that sort of sucrosity. But fundamentally, it's the quality of the wood that we're after. And, you know, the better the chateau, the better the wood they bought. It's as simple as that. We're not interested in using the chateau names or any cheap trick like that. We're interested in the quality of the wood. And the better the chateau, the better the wood, the quicker they sell them on. So it's a no-brainer to me. Is you go to, you know, WineWise, our friends from the wine world, and you get their cast-offs, that they no longer need. So that's, I suppose another wine trade connection.
Yeah.
You know, we've used, at least six different types of wood per farm in the same proportions. So each farm is maturing in the same wood types. So each farm is potentially a single bottling in its own right. And that's a deliberate strategy right from the beginning. So that now, when we come to looking to release our first bottlings, what is it that we're going to release? And the idea was to show people what we've been working on, to share our excitement and our discoveries with those that are interested. So we're going to bottle up some single farms as a sort of compare and contrast. You don't believe me about terroir in whiskey? Well, let me show you two different farms. They've now got 3 years, 4 years of barrel age. Of course, if you distill low and slow, if you use really good wood, and you use exceptional barley, it's no surprise. This is something I learned at Bruichladdich. You know, it's no surprise that your whiskey tastes really good much earlier than we've all been led to believe. You know, those ideas that it's got to be a 10-year-old and a 15-year-old. You know, who says? Who ever said it had to be that? Now, you know, when you win tasting competitions ahead of 35-year-old, you know, dregs of a barrel with a 5-year-old spirit, you know, that's sort of telling you something. That, you know, if you do it properly, and slow it all down and use good ingredients and take care, it's no surprise that your spirit tastes bloody good really soon. So actually, I would advocate that age statements are a complete misrepresentation. They are completely confusing. You know, if you use shitty wood, you know, it's going to have to be in there for 20, 30 years before it's remotely drinkable. You know, if you use, you know, high speed, high density stuff, you know, well, yes, it's going to take longer, you know, but it doesn't have to be that way. So whilst it's obviously a lot more expensive doing what we're doing, one of the benefits is that we have spirit that tastes better sooner. And I think you've seen that yourself. So actually all this age stuff goes out the window. In fact, we're not even use an age statement. It's actually misleading, I think. You look at the thing and go, oh, well, you know, 20 must be double as good as 10. Well, no, it isn't. Mm-hmm. You know, the older the whiskies are these days, the chances are the crappier the spirit. You know, it really is, the bottom of the barrel thing, you know, where of course, the older it is, the more valuable it's perceived, and the less good the spirit. You know, it really is an idiot's, a mug's game. It's where it's at is in younger spirits that are being made properly. That's where it's at. In which case, forget the age statements. They're meaningless. It's just a yardstick. So I can charge this because you charge that. How much do you charge for a 10-year-old? Oh, we charge that. Oh, brilliantly. To the extent that you've got one spirits company, one of the big guys, who actually went out with a campaign a while ago saying age matters. They were so alarmed by this, you know, this sort of usurping of young spirits. You know, and they had all this lovely old stuff. And they're going, hold on a second, age matters. Well, it's actually the quality of the spirit that matters. The goal of all this, this is this is intellectually intriguing. Compare and contrast. We are having fun. Ned is having fun. Where does he start? We've got 40 farms a year. We've got 100 and something different farms in our warehouses. We have 4 million litres of whiskey chosen and distilled by farm. The permutations are extraordinary. Now, the aim of all this, the whole theory behind what we're trying to do, is how do you make the most profound whiskey possible? That's the aim. And it borrows unashamedly from the wine world, from my upbringing. The Grand Vin de Château Latour. I mean, you look at that label, and the two words you see first of all, given equal prominence to the Chateau, are Grand Vin, the big wine, because it's made up of 50 little wines, 5 different grape varieties grown around the 35-acre estate, harvested, vinified, barreled separately, and then 18 months later assembled to create the big wine. That's where they get the complexity from. Each of the component individual wines would be perfectly drinkable on their own, but they wouldn't have that level of complexity, of stacked complexity. That is what the Grand Vin concept of those great Bordeaux wines is all about. Grand Cuvée, Krug. I remember spending time with Remy Krug in his cellars in Reims. And I remember him saying, he had all the sample component wines there. He was making the next Grand Cuvée. And he said, Mark, he said, with a single vintage, which these all are, they're all single vintages. He said, I'm not in charge. God is in charge. He determines the weather. He determines how those grapes evolve. We make the wine and there they are. But the Grand Cuvée, I'm God. And I never, ever forgot that. He is in charge. He is assembling from those individual components to make a style that he is trying to achieve, the Grand Cuvée. That is what we're doing at Waterford. We're making a Grand Cuvée or a Grand Vin, whichever way you want to look at it. Now, our components are the individual farms, the individual terroirs, with their own specific characters. Now, you know, we've had them analysed by gas chromatography, mass spectron gas chromatography. And that gives you a spider graph that shows the attributes on a flavour wheel of that spirit. It's unequivocal. There it is. The latest mass spectron gas chromatography has such sensitivity that you can have a sensory perception module attached to it. So now not only can you see the data, but you can match up the sensory perception to it. That's the latest. And Cork University has one of these, which is why we're using it for our terroir proving project. So I can show you each of those single farms, and I can show you that each of them has a different makeup. They are there. You know, it's unequivocal. There it is. They're different. We made a film of it. It's on our website. It's a film that throbs with each one of these And in fact, the film was made up of just 30 of the farms, because that's all we had at that time when we made the film. We need to update it. It is the most enthralling thing to see. It pulsates as each farm's analysis comes up. You can see how different they are. Now, if you stack one of those graphs on top of the other graph, on top of the other graph, on top of the other, you start to see, you know, layer upon layer upon layer. And that's what it's about. Those are flavors, layers. A lot of them are the same, similar flavors, but a lot of them also aren't. You know, they're different permutations, different levels. And you stack those up. It goes back to those Murray McDavid ideas of having four or five barrels put together is often better than one on its own. And an analogy I would use, a bottling is a bit like a piece of celluloid film. You remember the film, you get that stuff. And it's a whole series of frames. And each frame is a barrel. Okay? You could take one frame and look at it, and it's all blurred, and it's all out of focus, and you can't quite understand what the film's about. And you put it back, and you take another frame, and this one is crystal clear. And you go, oh, yeah. It gives you an idea of what that film is. That is a bottling. Some barrels, ordinary. Some barrels, perfection. Some barrels, you know, like this. Some barrels like that. If you put them together, that's where you get the complexity that we're looking for. That's where you get that grand vin status. The sum of the parts being better than the individual components. It's not rocket science. It's been going on for years. Now, the trouble is, people say, oh, well, that, you know, that's what whiskey is. You know, whiskey is just made up of lots of different barrels. Well, yes, it is. But not barrels of whiskey distilled at the one distillery, and not barrels of whiskey distilled from barley from individual farms. You know, that's the difference. You know, so yes, blending whiskey is one thing. Vatting it is a different thing altogether. Vatting it from your own whiskey, from your own farms, each with its own identity, is a very, very different thing. And that's, you asked, you know, what's our bread and butter? That's our bread and butter, is to make a Waterford whiskey on the same lines as a grand vin or a grand cuvée, where the sum of the parts is compelling, layers of flavour, so that when you smell it, you know, you'll just keep smelling it, because layer after layer after layer is going to be released. That's the idea. It's like a millefeuille gâteau, you know, those layers and layers of pastry. That's the idea. It's a very simple one. But it means you've got to have those components, which means you've got to have the infrastructure, which means you've got to have the logistics, which means you've got to have, you know, all that differentiation, which means you've got to have the traceability, which means you've got to have the terroir, and it means you've got to be able to prove it and substantiate it. It is unprecedented. No one has done this before in any spirit. I started it with Brooklady. We didn't have the logistics. We didn't have the money. We didn't have the wherewithal. We didn't have the know-how. We had resistance from within and without. It was, you know, we tried, but with certainly we were able to prove that it worked. Waterford has allowed me, with the extraordinary people and extraordinary goodwill and can-do attitude, we were able to start from day one with everything that you need to do. There is nothing I could have done better. So I'm happy as Larry. There's not, oh, if only we'd done this, if only we'd done. Everything I ever wanted to do, we were able to do from day one. So we didn't have to retrofit it. We didn't have to sort of, you know, which we had to do at Brooklyn. It's there from day one. And that's, you know, the great people like Michael Stafford, who did the warehousing, and Alan Dempsey with the malting, the farmers, the agronomists, you know, Grace, who's there helping us with the agronomy, Ned, you know, everybody. It's a collaborative effort, and everybody's wanted to be involved. Everybody's bought into it, and everybody, yeah, well, you've seen it for yourself, you know, is convinced by what we've done. You know, we don't have to evangelize about this. You know, it's there. It's whether people are interested or not. And to be honest, you know, we're really interested. You know, the man in the street, is he as interested? Probably not. Do I care? No. It's you know, if you're going to lay stuff down, if you're going to go to these extremes and these lengths, it sure helps to be interested. But I think there's nothing wrong with a bit of elitism. I think there's nothing wrong with aspiration. I think there's nothing wrong with an intellectual proposition, a curiosity. You know, what are you going to do? Drink the same stuff you've drunk, you know, since the end. You know, as a wine guy, you don't go into a wine shop and say, oh, give me the same as I had last time. You what you do is you say, what's new? And a good retailer will say, ah, we've got this new. You had that last time. Try this. You'll like this. You open your eyes. That's what it's about. So that's what I want to do with whiskey. It's not just a monotone, standard, one-dimensional thing. It's multidimensional if you want it to be. I want people to try this one and that one. I want them to compare and contrast. I want them to try different varieties. I want them to try different soil types. I want them to try different wood types. You know, all of this we can do. All of this. We have created such diversity that we can cut that cake any which way we want to do it. And we shall be cutting that cake in many different ways. But fundamentally, we will have a Waterford whiskey cuvée, which will be the multidimensional grand vin. We will have single farms, and we will release different versions and different... We'll play games with it. You know, lots of different ones to follow. So what I would hope is that on your drinks tray, you'll have perhaps a Waterford whiskey, but then you'll have some single farms, and we'll sit down and we'll have a dram, and we will savour the flavour. You know, this isn't for hoovering down. This isn't for, you know, a whiskey chasers. This isn't for mixing. This is for enjoying and exploring and revealing itself to you over time. That's the thrill. That's the fun of real whiskey. When it's got something to deliver and something to give and something for you to find, something for you to explore, something for you to get to know. Yeah, sure. The style will be Waterford. You'll see that a mile away. You'll taste that a mile away. But the nuances, the subtleties, the complexities, the stimulations, that's what it's about. And of course, the older it gets, the more, you know, we've got to play with. You know, yes. I think no one would be mad enough to do this again. The barrier to entry is considerable. I think intellectually, you've got to know what you're trying to do, and that's what we come back to. You know, how this industry is very good at purloining, you know, magpie-like ideas that they think will resonate with the public without actually understanding it. So yes, you are starting to see other distillers copying what we're doing, but they don't actually get it. Some do, but most don't. They're just playing at it. They're saying, oh, that works for them, so we'll use that. And that's sadly is the whiskey industry's Achilles' heel is it can't stop copying. Innovating, it's not very good at. Big companies don't innovate. So real innovation comes from the smaller guys. And, you know, certainly in Ireland, you've got a lot of guys coming to it who just, you know, they're either dreamers, you know, they've got this idea, they want to do it, or they're pragmatists. If they're pragmatists, they don't have the background. If they're dreamers, they, you know, so there's quite a lot missing, I think, you know, joining the dots up. But I certainly think Irish whiskey is a very exciting place to be. I can't think of anywhere I'd rather be, you know, for whiskey than Ireland. The enthusiasm is amazing. Sometimes that gets a little bit carried away, I think. And there's a little bit of Wild West thrown in, but I've enjoyed every minute of Waterford. It's been an absolutely fantastic opportunity that has developed into this. Well, and now we can actually show people. This is the point, you know. Finally, you know, you can actually will as of the spring be able to see what we're talking about. And that, I tell you, is like, you know, Christ, it's like, you know, the relief of actually letting people share what you're doing. And it's up to them to say, well, it's a load of hot air, or it's a load of this or a load of that. But I think you'll find that it's quite intriguing. I feel quite good about it.
Thank you so much, Mark. It was an absolute pleasure to sit with you over these two episodes. And I'm sure you would agree that these set the scene very nicely for an exploration of production over at Waterford. Do, of course, check out below for the website and main social media handles for Waterford Distillery. If you haven't already, do please subscribe to the podcast so you're alerted when new episodes go live over at interpretingwine.com/listen. And if you're not already, I would love to have you following along with me on social media, where I'm at Interpreting Wine on Instagram and Facebook, at Wine Podcast on Twitter, and email hello@interpretingwine.com. Next time in the Waterford Distillery Special, I sit down with Waterford Agronomy Specialist, Grace O'Reilly. See you then.